I gathered before me of silver, of gold, the treasure of kings and a province of wold. I made myself singers of women and men, delights of mankind and of ladies. Amen. That was Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 8, from the 2020 version of Ward Green. Our daily scripture for today, little children. We're going to return to the movie, I think, before we begin our study. This is the Kon-Tiki movie by Thor Heyerdahl and his crew from 1950. We're on 34 minutes and 40 seconds or so.
We're off to inspect the lashings. We built a so-called diving basket with the rather rough and ready materials we had at hand. An old fruit basket from Peru had its sides extended with the addition of rope and slats. When completed, it had the desired effect on sharks as well as on us. We knew that should we have an unwelcome visitor, we had only to crouch down inside the basket while the crew on deck hauled us out as quickly as possible. The diving basket is lowered for its first trial. After adjusting his diving goggles, Haugland takes his place in the basket. Once underneath the raft, he has a unique experience. Not only does he see the ropes and balsa logs, but numerous tropical fish of all sorts of shapes and colors. It was as though one had an aquarium under one's living room floor, a floating tank that would accompany us all the way across the Pacific. Diving under the raft now proved a highly popular diversion. In fact, the Kon-Tiki acquired a new and entertaining basement in addition to its masthead and its deck. We were never going to be really bored. Unfortunately, the film of the interior of the hut was spoiled by seawater, but we have preserved photographs. Danielson is reading one of the 73 ethnological tracts he brought with him on the expedition. Haugland has just baited a hook with a whole dolphin fish to lure a shark. When we had a visitor, we shall never forget. It was the world's largest fish, the whale shark. As we hauled the dolphin fish on board, the monster came gliding straight for the Kon-Tiki. The whale shark is easily identifiable, as its head and back are covered with white spots. According to zoologists, this rare giant whale measures from 15 to 20 meters in length. Here can be seen the striped pilot fish that frisk peacefully in front of the shark's wide jaws. When it came right up to the edge of the raft...
A whale shark is a fish, not a whale. whales are mammals, and this is the largest fish, he said, and I believe it's not a whale, it's a fish.
I saw that its huge toad-like head is so large that its jaws are a meter and a half in width. Zoologists report that it has some 3,000 teeth in each jaw. So large was this creature that we feared for the woodwork and the ropes should it attack us with its enormously powerful tail. But no attack was forthcoming. It swam calmly up to the Contiki and then dived under it to reappear on the other side. It was so large that when its head re-emerged on one side of the raft, its tail was still visible on the other side. It continued swimming round and under the raft, and naturally we were not a little concerned as to how this visit would end. We had no firearms, only a few hand harpoons and a fish spear.
It's a shark, right? So it sounds like it's a fish. Anyway, that's enough of the movie for today. It sounds more like a fish than, we could look it up. I think we can look it up and see. Just on Wikipedia, look up whale shark. It'll tell us if it's a fish or not. It's a fish, yeah. It's a shark. Largest known fish species. So it's not a whale. It's called a whale shark, but it's not a whale. That's important because it's so large, it would have been able to swallow a man, and therefore where the Bible says that Jonah was swallowed by a fish, the whale shark could have been the fish that did that. So it's important that there is a fish large enough to swallow a man, because the Bible doesn't say that it was a whale that swallowed Jonah. It was, in fact, a fish, according to the scriptures. So in every respect, even though the Bible is not a science textbook, it's really accurate scientifically. That's another piece of evidence in that regard. Now, we're studying the article, The Ark of Urartu, again today, continuing in chapter 1, and we're on paragraph 7. We've seen the photograph yesterday on the right, which is the wall of heaven with Mount Judy in the right background. And the ark is in the foreground on the right here. And also, we're going to see, let's look at it now. The picture at the end of this paragraph is the military photo taken by the Turkish military in 1958 or 59, that showed the shape of what looked like a boat. And you see that it's pointed at one end, so that is consistent, and rounded at the other end, which is in fact consistent with the drawing. I was wondering about that yesterday, but the drawing that was made by Mr. Windsor, the naval architect, is like that, you see, his drawing, quite consistent with that shape. That's the top view. This is more of a side view here, below, looking from the side. So the top view of it looks very much like that photograph, does it not? So that's quite significant that he's really paid careful attention to the actual shape of the relic here, which is in evidence and apparently really is Noah's Ark, because it's not only shaped like a boat, but it had the dimensions that were given in the Bible for the vessel known as Noah's Ark, with the unit of the cubit equal to an Egyptian cubit of 20.6 inches. And the total length of the relic that was measured on the site was 515 feet, which made it equal to 300 Egyptian royal cubits, something that was also recorded as cubits without the qualification Egyptian royal in the Bible in the book of Genesis with regard to the size of the ark. We looked that up the other day. I believe it's in chapter 6. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Genesis chapter 6, because the flood arrived in chapter 7 of Genesis. But if you look at this picture, it's just remarkable, isn't it? It's such a regular-shaped object, like, so brilliant. And then you see also, looks like something jabbing into the side there. That's the rock outcropping that struck the side of the ark as it slid down the mountain, evidently, in the mud flow that came perhaps centuries after the landing at the top of the mountain, when the ark landed as navigated by our patriarch Noah. It's just a remarkable thing. Gilgamesh has been identified as a ruler of ancient times. He features in the Sumerian clay tablets of the Epic of Gilgamesh, the oldest unsourced account of the deluge. Let's see here. What can we do? There we go. Right. In that work, the Ark is described as being an iku in area, which is compared to today's unit area, the acre in size. Doesn't it even sound the same? Iku and acre? With a great Babylonian cubit of 21 inches. So the Babylonian cubit, the great Babylonian cubit, which would be larger than the smaller Babylonian cubit, but the great one was 21 inches, even bigger than the Royal Egyptian cubit, apparently. And with the great Babylonian cubit of 21 inches, and the iku given as 120 cubits square, 120 by 120, the deck area of the ark is calculated, 120 times 21 in inches, right? 120 cubits times 21 inches per cubit. And then the other, it's a square. We're talking about the area of a square, which is 120 great Babylonian cubits on each side. So we multiply it times the other side to get the area, and the other side's the same. So it's 120 times 21 times 120 times 21. And that equals, oh, it would be shameful if this didn't work out when I do it right now. You can also say 120 squared times 21 squared is the same way of calculating. It's the same way of doing that. It's 6,350,400 square inches. Okay, but from that we have to divide, of course, that by 144 to get it in square feet, if we want it square feet. 44,100 square feet, just exactly as I've calculated in the article as well. Accepting, you see, we can say 120 times 21 times 120 times 21, but we can also say 120 times 120 times 21 times 21, which is 120 squared times 21 squared. It's the same thing, because these operations, like multiplication, is what's called, is it commutative, or I think it's commutative, where you can switch it around and do it in a different order and it doesn't change anything. So, I mean, if you've got 'I've got allergies, the hay fever, you know, very bad right now, and I'm not running my filter when I'm making a video, so I apologize. As 1 square inch, then we calculated into square feet by dividing by 144, which is the number 12 times 12, the number of inches, square inches in a square foot, right? Or the number of, yeah, 1 square inch is 1/144th of a square foot. 1/144th, because there are 12 inches in a foot, and 1 square inch is 1/12th in both directions, or 1 inch is 1/12th of a foot, and we're multiplying 1/12th of a foot times the 1/12th of a foot to get 1/144th of a square foot for 1 square inch, and that's why we divide by 144 to get the number of square feet. Okay. So 44,000 square feet. Now, accepting that Noah's Ark, that was according to the Babylonians, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Accepting that Noah's Ark has been measured with radar and metal detectors at Uzengili and found as 6,180 inches long. Let's do that. It should get 515 feet, shouldn't we? If we divide by 12, 515 feet, right. We need to verify everything every time we read it, because who knows, maybe there's a mistake somewhere. But anyone may now measure the Ark's area with an aerial shot. You see, because if we know the length of it, we can use the photograph and we can figure out what the area of that is, knowing its length. We can plot that up. Maybe we can even, if we can't do it mathematically, we could do it by drawing up a large graph and measuring the length of it, deciding how long a foot was. If 515 feet is that length of that boat in the photograph, then we make a square that's equal to 1 foot by 1 foot, and we put as many of them as we can inside that shape and figure out how many square feet are there. So that can be done just from the photograph once we know the length of it. So we have a standard calibration there. And then, calibrating the Ark's dimension, I find the area of the Ark is, in fact, quite close to the modern acre. The acre at 66 by 660 feet is 98.7755% of the ancient Iku. Let's do that. Let's see. 99 or 66. 66 times 660. Right? Divided by 44,100. Is that what it is? I think that's what we're trying to find out. 98.7755%. If I multiply by 100, I'd get in percent. 98.7755. Okay. Exactly right. So that's what that is. Now, the acre is 66 by 660 feet. How big is an acre? Let's just verify that. An acre, a unit of area. There it is. 66 by 660 feet, according to Wikipedia. No worries then. We're It's amazing then, isn't it, that the ancient Iku we were able to determine from knowing how big the Babylonian cubit was, which is 21 inches, bigger than the Royal Egyptian cubit. But based on knowing these things and knowing what the Epic of Gilgamesh said, the Iku is 120 by 120 cubits, and each cubit's 21 inches, and calculating that like we just did, we determined that our modern acre is exactly 98.7755, or pretty close to exactly 100%, essentially, of the ancient Iku. Gilgamesh gets the dimensions, it's very close, it's 99%. Gilgamesh gets the dimensions of the Ark directly from its builder, Utnapishtim, who is said to be a deluge survivor. Now, of course, it could have been Shem, Utnapishtim, if he was just a survivor and not... If he wasn't Noah, but if he was Noah, then, I mean, it would determine that Gilgamesh must have lived and visited the site earlier, because Noah died before Shem did. Or did he? Wait a minute. I'm trying to think now. How long did Shem live after the deluge? Noah lived 350 years after the deluge. We've got to find out. Okay, let's look up Shem. Yeah, I think it's in this article where we're going to talk about Shem. So here he is, Shem. He lived 600 years. And he lived 500 years after the deluge. So he lived 150 years after the death of Noah in 2932. That's what I calculated the death of Noah as yesterday. 2932 BCE was the death of Noah, 350 years after 3282. 3282 minus 350, because Noah was 600 years old at the time of the deluge, right? And he died at the age of 950. So that means 350 is how long he lived after. So 2932 BCE was when he died. But we subtract another, because Shem lived 500 years, there would be another 150 for Shem, so he would have lived until 2782. That's just about, yeah, he died just about the time, just before the building of the Tower of Babel and before Nimrod. So Gilgamesh existed before Nimrod, so that's still true, even after considering all of that. Okay, so these are using the Septuagint numbers, too, for the Bible. We're using the most ancient tradition of the Septuagint, which is different from the Masoretic text, in some cases for certain things. The total number of years that the patriarchs lived may not have been altered, but they altered something. For example, they altered the age of the patriarchs at which they begat their sons, and so, that's the topic for another day anyway. But we just have to be aware that the Masoretic text, in some cases, differs greatly, significantly, and undesirably from the Masoretic text, which is a later tradition, differs from the earlier tradition of the Septuagint. The earliest Masoretic text I just heard today in a video was evidently in the 10th century of our Common Era, something like 900 and something of the Common Era, or the Christian Era, you could call it. The point, so where are we? We're still in paragraph 7, right? We are wise to be wary, though, of evidence based on myths, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh. We may have dated the deluge. We certainly did the best we could. And the Bible we have reason to believe as historical. But without a date, Gilgamesh may be a manifestation of mythical characters of various ages. Now, the Sumerian flood account, the deluge account, is quite close to the biblical account, so it's not necessarily a mythical, or it's not necessarily something that contains a large number of mythical elements, but we need to be aware that it could be mythical, and therefore it could contain characters from different periods of time, which myths often do, in the Greek myths, for example, and the Roman. And all the other myths that we know came much later. But there is a tale about the world's first king, Nimrod, that tells how he came to be the first to wear a crown when he saw in a vision a crown coming down from heaven. So this could be the wall of heaven, you see, because the story says the crown was coming down from heaven. So that's what's so interesting to me, is the fact that it said from heaven, because the wall of heaven was the cliff at the ark site, which looks like a crown. And the story, thus, we could say, is causing some to miss the idea that Nimrod had the crown manufactured, because it was said he saw it coming down from heaven, so some people might take it as a myth, that meaning that the crown literally came down from heaven. But they may miss that idea that he saw the wall of heaven, so the crown came down to his mind from that, and then he manufactured the crown. Gilgamesh, who some say was Nimrod. Yeah, some people say that Gilgamesh was Nimrod. That's another thing. And we saw that he almost dated to the time of Nimrod, even in our chronology. So that's remarkable. I mean, he could have, if he lived long enough, he could have lived in the time when Shem was still alive and still have lived long enough after that, from 2782, I think we just found, until the Tower of Babel, which was sometime around, trying to think, when 2741 for the division of the land or something like that, but 2745 for the scattering, was it, of the people, or the confusion of languages, I'm thinking. We had given a date for these events in our chronology the best we could. We gave dates, so it's sometime around 2750 or 2740 when these events of the Tower of Babel appear to have occurred. So Gilgamesh could have still been alive about 30 years after he saw Shem in his very last days. I mean, if Shem is Utnapishtim, see, Shem and the name Shem is actually contained in the last five letters there, something similar to that in the name Utnapishtim. But Gilgamesh, who some say was Nimrod, had sought immortality when he went to see Utnapishtim. And as he saw the wall of heaven, he saw the crown of its summit in shape a diadem, or crown. So there we have it. So this is why Gilgamesh, some say, was Nimrod, because he did see the crown, which was the wall of heaven, and looked like a crown, that is, which is the mountain at the ark site. And so, you know, that corresponds to what is said about Nimrod seeing a crown that came down from heaven. So therefore, some say that Gilgamesh was Nimrod. But does this prove that the object at Uzengili is Noah's Ark? That's really more, I guess, what we're interested in. But it's very interesting about Nimrod. But we need to know whether this is really Noah's Ark. It seems to me, it seems to be very obvious we need to be interested in that. So Mr. Windsor did something remarkable here. What is this? Oh, there's some kind of a paper here. Not sure what it's going to pop up as. That's the same thing. Oh, yeah, it's the same article that we had of Mr. Windsor's. Okay. So that's good. That's good for today. We've done it for today. That's chapter 1, verse, or paragraph 7. Of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. We're finished that. We've got five more minutes now before we're, you know, out of time for today, unless we stop early. I'm trying to think what else there is to talk about today. Well, there's always more to talk about. I mean, I'm finding that shopping is such an enormous privilege and pleasure, as it is also a privilege to make these videos and a pleasure. But shopping nowadays can be done online almost exclusively. You almost never have to go to a store, but there are certain items that are far better when they're purchased at a store, or easier to purchase, such as, you know, toxic chemicals like paint and things like that, that they don't like to ship them. And so they're very expensive to ship. Oil paint, for example, or oil stain. And maybe even it's expensive to ship batteries and things like lead acid batteries. So it might be better for one to purchase those items or similar items locally at a local store. But there's so many things that can be bought online. I bought some boots the other day. Yeah. The Nortive 8 boots that I bought. And I'd shopped for boots and was looking at some brand name boots. I could talk about this for days because there's so many details involved in shopping. But now I'm shopping for a reverse osmosis countertop unit that can do reverse osmosis. But I'm realizing, well, I've been shopping for it, and I tried to purchase one and I've just been refunded because they think the package was lost. But if it doesn't arrive, it doesn't look like it necessarily will, then I might want to still purchase another reverse osmosis unit. But to buy that, I have to shop and consider, the things to consider are how much are the replacement filters for the device, you know, because the water will eventually deposit enough minerals and so on in the filters that it will ruin the filter. You have to replace the filter. So I need to consider which units are available, first of all, when I can have them shipped to me the very next day, because if I have to wait for a week, it might never arrive, as we've seen when it comes from outside the country. That can happen more often. But the other thing is, the filters, if they can't be shipped the same day and arrive the next day, then it's a problem because, well, eventually we probably won't be able to get the filters anyway. So how long are these things going to last? That's the problem with these reverse osmosis filters. So I need to do a lot more research maybe than I thought initially. But about these boots, about the boots, and I'm shopping for so many things. I bought some new belts. I'm thrilled with the leather belts I bought for $20, roughly, $20 each. Leather, genuine leather belts with quality buckles. I bought two belts because my waist size got somewhat larger recently, and I didn't have many belts, or hardly had any belts that fit me. But I'm thinking of making my own belts also out of some leather that I bought. But coming back to the boots, you can buy $400 boots, right? And I was looking for non-waterproof boots because waterproof boots are always going to be sweaty or too hot in the summer. And they're never really as good because of that. And the waterproofing may not even hold up, but it's going to prevent you from breathing. Your feet will not breathe. So I had a great deal of difficulty finding boots that weren't waterproof, for one thing. But the other thing was to get boots that were purchased in large quantities that had very favorable reviews. I had to shop for a long time, and then I found a $400 boot that I almost purchased a pair of. But then I found this company, Nortive 8. Nortive 8 produces boots, and they're interested in producing them very economically. But they've even got ratings that exceed some of the brand name boots in online reviews from independent reviewers. And they're not based, the review is not based on price, it's based on the quality of the boot. And they still, at $68 Canadian, the Nortive boots performed, in some cases, in certain reviews, better. Just they were rated as better than the expensive, more expensive, you know, $150 boots. So Monday, it's September 9th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 17:04 North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. Thank you for listening and watching, and in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.